Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning once again, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully I will say boys and girls. Be nice if some boys and girls were listening right now, but I wouldn't blame them for spending their time on a Saturday morning doing something else. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is Jake McClure on the line with me. I have the elder Baldy rather than me, the younger Baldy. Jeff McClure, are you there?
Are you there?
Yep.
All right. Wow, it worked. Technology sort of works sometimes. Welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is a program that we talk about investing. We talk about the economy in a broad sense and try to make some sense out of it for people. In a broad sense, we make sense out of it. Sensically. That's what I say. But we have some disclosures that we have to say first. And the very first one that we will say is that this is being brought to you. It's called the Personal Wealth Coach. The Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. And coincidentally, the people doing the radio program are the principals at that firm. Having said that...
Coincidentally,
or it is...
I don't think it's a coincidence.
Well, it was a coincidence, but it was a purposeful coincidence, not just by... It was not a happenstantial coincidence. So just because we're registered with the SEC doesn't mean that they've approved us in any way. In fact, they don't approve of anything. That is not their job. Their job is to find things to disapprove of. The reason why we say how the firm is registered is because if we say something that's too particular on this program, those are the folks that you complain to. We offer investment advice, fiduciary investment advice from our firm. On the air, we can't give you investment advice. Well, why? Why not, Jake? You're licensed to do it. Jeff, you're licensed to do it. Why aren't you giving investment advice on the air? What would you say?
I would say investment advice is given to individuals based on their specific circumstances, goals, and objectives, and risk tolerance, and you can't do that on the air.
Do you speak like that in your normal conversations?
Of course, I speak like that in my normal conversations.
It's investment advice is specific to the people and their goals, specific objectives, and risk tolerances. And the reality is, it's absolutely true. Investment advice, if you're going to give advice to someone that's in their best interest, you really have to know what their interests are. And we don't know the interests of all the people that are listening to this program, all four of us that are listening together.
Well, wait a minute. You're making an assumption that there's four of us listening to the program.
There's at least two people that are on the program, and then there's going to be people that listen to it before we post it online. So there's at least four people. They may not be listening live, and we do occasionally get reports on our ratings, and we're being facetious here. Our ratings are pretty good, but when we're having these conversations, it's worthwhile to be humble. And I've never understood the word humble. How do we have a silent H in there? Shouldn't it just be humble? And isn't it humility? Why isn't it humility? I don't know. Anyway, that was the investment advice disclosure. You've got some to give as well.
We don't pay for this radio program, nor are we paid to do the radio program. We do pay for advertising on KTEM. We pay regular rates for advertising on KTEM. And they, a long time ago, decided to let us do the radio program, or ask us to do the radio program.
I think it's more like forced us to.
Well, it was an ask, but the issue is it may be because we advertised for the radio program on the radio station that they let us do the radio program. I don't know, but we do it anyway. And they don't pay us. We don't pay them. We do it as a public service.
Right. And we do get some business out of it, very rarely. Most of what we get out of it is communication with clients. A lot of our clients listen to this. So if that's you, then you know it's you. If it's not, then why not? Purpose of the program, I was saying it earlier, we talk about investing, we talk about mistakes people make, we talk about things that you should be aware of in the market and in the economy and what maybe to expect. There's certainly no guarantees about the future. Man, is that ever an understatement? Yogi Berra said it really, really well. The future's just certainly not what it used to be. So, do you want to jump into what happened this week in the market and in the economy?
Well, the S&P 500 stock index, otherwise affectionately known as the SPX, dropped 2.51% for the week. So we closed on Friday at 3340.97. Why is that significant? Well, because it's been going up a long time. It's been rising in value, and it's falling relatively fast. It's down about 6.7% from its peak that it hit about a week ago, a little over a week ago. And is now down, so in a week it's lost all the gains it had in a month. It's still up pretty high, though. The gains for 2020 from January 1st to the present is 3.41%, still up about 11% from a year ago. It's about 1.33% down from its high in February. That doesn't mean the fact that the market's down 6.7% doesn't mean it's cheap, though. It is still very expensive. Matter of fact, the trailing, I mean, we look at the earnings over the last year, which obviously have been depressed since the coronavirus hit, but we don't know how much. The trailing earnings, it's the price of the market is 28.72 times, roughly 29 times its earnings, if you look at all the S&P 500, which is kind of nosebleed country because the average over the long period of time for the trailing earnings is 15.82. So we're almost twice the price that the market has averaged. And I know that technically the S&P 500 hasn't existed that long, but there's data going back to 1872 that they call the S&P 500. And then in that entire period of time, it's averaged about 16 as a trailing earnings, and it's currently running at 28.72. So,
what does that mean? What is the price to earnings? There are some folks that don't know that.
The price times the earnings. In other words,
price
easiest way to understand that
divided
by the earnings. In other words, it would take if you took the earnings of the S&P 500, all the profits of the companies that make up the S&P 500, and you look at the S&P 500, and if you're buying an S&P 500 index fund, and it's really inexpensive, you're going to be real close to this result. It would take almost 30 years of those profits to pay for one share of the S&P 500, and that is expensive. That's like if you bought a rental property. Let's say you bought a rental house and you paid cash for it, and you looked at the free cash flow from the rent. Presuming the thing stays fully rented, and in only 30 years, your profits would pay you back for the house. You probably wouldn't buy that house.
That's probably the case, unless there was some kind of sentimental value on that house that made me think that maybe grandma was born there or something. I wouldn't look at that as a good investment.
In other words, the price of the stock market is unusually expensive right now, and unfortunately, so is the bond market. So it makes it rough to figure out where to go.
Does that mean that there's nothing in the stock market that's priced correctly?
No, it doesn't. That's the point I was going to make, that there are areas of the stock market, it's called the value side of the stock market, for example, it's down about 13% so far this year from January 1st, that are trading at very reasonable price-to-earnings ratios. There's about 10 stocks that are driving the value of the S&P 500 stock index, and they're all priced ridiculously high. The top, I think, as I recall, the top 10 stocks about a week ago averaged a price of 83 times earnings, which is absurd. We've seen this before. The last time we saw it was in the year 2000, 1999 and 2000. And inevitably, we've had a major correction or a bear market following the market getting this expensive.
Oh.
Okay. Anyway, corporate earnings are down. The economy is down of roughly 20% from where it was, according to Moody's. And the stock market was until last week, actually, breaking records, which is weird. And this is one of those situations where irrational exuberance seems to reign. There's a lot of evidence that the reason the market has risen so high is because an awful lot of individual investors with small accounts are trading options.
Yeah, lots and lots of it.
They're buying the option to force a sale of the stock at a higher price, which forces people to buy the stock on the other end of the transaction. It's a little bit complicated. But the bottom line to it is it's being driven by a tidal wave of amateur investors in places like Robinhood and discount brokers that are charging nothing for buying stock, and they still charge a little bit for buying options, but not a lot, and an awful lot of people are gambling with options. With options, what you can do is you can buy thousands of dollars worth of stock. Effectively, you can buy the right to buy those stocks for a few hundred dollars. And then ideally, before you're forced to buy the stocks, you sell the option. And if the stocks have risen, the option has risen in value with it, and you can make a lot of money, or you can lose a lot of money in a very short period of time. And there's an awful lot of people betting on a bull market. They're betting on stocks going up, and that causes stocks to go up. But when they start to sell those options, when they stop buying the options, when the tide reverses, the stock market then would go down. And this may not be the beginning of the major correction that the stock market is very likely to see, but it also could be. Something's going on, and one of the odd things, well, not really odd, because chaos theory kind of predicts this kind of thing to happen. There's no specific set of news that made the market go down. It's like there was no specific set of news that made the market go up.
Well, I would say that last week there was some news that caused the market to begin its downward, but what caused that to continue? And that weirdness was that Tesla didn't make it into the S&P 500. Should that have caused the entire market to collapse? No. Did it? Yes. that's the only piece of news, and Tesla was being bid up and bid up and bid up, and all the rumors were saying they're going to be in the S&P 500. Tesla stock price dropped 20% on news that it was not going to be in the S&P 500. And I think that is it's a statement about the irrational exuberance that we're seeing in the market. Would being in the S&P 500 make Tesla a more profitable company long-term? No.
Well, I think the people who are doing the buying and have run the stock market up to record levels and run the price-earnings ratios up to what is referred to as nosebleed country don't care about corporate earnings. They don't care about the fundamentals of the companies they're buying. They said, if it goes up, I'll buy it. If it goes down, I'll sell it.
Right.
It's the old thing that Will Rogers said, that buy stocks, and if they go up,
sell them.
If they don't go up, don't buy them in the first place.
Man, that's the best investment set of wisdom that I have heard ever in my career. If only we could all follow it. It's difficult to follow it when you're. I mean, it's pretty simple advice. I don't know why we can't all follow it. Oh yeah.
The other side of this, and this is the side that also the reporter. There's another market out there called the bond market, and there's a base rate of return in the bond market for safety. If you want true safety, you buy treasuries, and the median price, the benchmark price in treasury securities is the 10-year treasury. The 10-year treasury is yielding 0.671% per year. You buy a 10-year treasury, you put $1,000 in a 10-year treasury right now, you will get, whether you need it or not, $6.71 a year.
Woohoo! Wait, how much money went in for $6.71?
No, it'd be for 100. You get $67.
There you go.
You get $67.10 a year from your treasury, which for $1,000, that's an amazingly low amount. Now, a year ago, the 10-year treasury was yielding 1.75%, which means you would have gotten $1,750 a year, which is not unreasonable for zero risk for a 10-year period. And it was pretty much a match for inflation at the time. It was running about 1.7%. Now that it's down to 0.671 and inflation has risen back up to about 1.7%, it's actually 1.3% for 12 months.
And you had another number that was wrong there. Last year you wouldn't have gotten a which one Let's kind of run back through what you would have gotten.
No, you'd have gotten $175.
There
I'm
you
sorry.
Go.
$175 a year for your $1,000 investment. All those zeros, those decimal points.
What are they doing around here?
Early in the morning, Saturday.
Yeah, and that's still not a correct number, but we'll go with it.
Well, 1.75%, $1,000. How much would you get a year?
Let's do a calculation, shall we? Do you have a calculator handy?
I've got a spreadsheet.
1% of 1,000. So we just take two decimal points or two zeros off the end, and you get 100.
Mm-hmm. So $175 a year is what you get.
Wait, is that correct? How many hundreds are in 1,000? 10. So that's right. 10%. So we're talking about less than that.
$175 a year?
Out of $1,000, that would still be a 16% yield. I realize we're used to talking about much larger numbers. So, I mean, 10% of $1,000 is $100. I don't know how you could get $167 if you had a 1.6. That's all I'm saying is that computers are necessary.
I was thinking of 10,000.
Yeah,
right.
And there are bonds that trade at 10,000. It's one of those things that when we use jargon, we're using a much smaller set of numbers to represent much bigger sets of numbers, and then it throws us off and it makes us feel weird because we're usually talking in tens of thousands of dollars in bonds and maybe millions of dollars, and it's a lot easier to calculate when you're used to doing it that way. That's funny because most people have the opposite, where the numbers get bigger and they have trouble with them. When we have the numbers get small, our brains start doing pretzel shapes. But any way you look at it, the interest rate on this stuff is really, really low. You're not making anywhere near as much money as you did last year. And last year, compared to 20 years ago, was a lot less than you would have gotten. Now we're. How long do you think we'll stay down here in this pit of interest rates?
Well, the bond market is forecasting that we'll be here for about 3 years, and then it will gradually get better. Whether or not the bond market is accurate, of course, is a question. The interest rates are pretty nearly at zero, just barely above zero, out to 3 years on the treasuries. So it's. It's really hard to say that it would be any higher. Now, inflation is also forecast. The bond market is also forecasting inflation to be extremely low during that period. And so zero interest, zero inflation is probably what we'll have for about 3 years. Now, the interesting thing is if you go out to 30 years, if you buy a 30-year treasury bond at this point, the interest rate is only 1.5% a year. So the problem with all of that is that interest rates are low and they're going to stay low for a long time is what the bond market is saying. And the bond market isn't a perfect predictor of what's going to happen in the future. I'm sorry, you know, I did, by the way, figure that and actually use my brain for a change. But if you had a 1.75% return on a $1,000 treasury bond, you get $17.50. You're right.
It's weird. Like I said, we're so used to dealing with much larger numbers, and the numbers are calculated by the computer. It's so easy to fall back. Well, of course you could get that much, because that's what you got in the 80s, right?
Yep. And the problem, of course, is that at 0.671%, you'd only get $6.71 a year for giving
$1,000.
$1,000. Well, if you gave them $10,000, you'd get $67, though.
Woohoo! That is about a Starbucks a month.
And people don't like that, so they're looking for higher rates of return, and they're taking some risks they probably shouldn't take. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we mentioned in the newsletter this week is that if you have a balanced portfolio and you've used the rule of thumb that I've seen published probably thousands of times, that you had 60% in the S&P 500 and you have 40% of your money split between government securities and corporate government notes, 10-year notes, and to intermediate corporates, which is, again, about 10-year maturity on the corporate bonds, you'd get a whopping 4% return probably over the next 10 years, according to the current estimates of what the S&P 500 is likely to return over the next 10 years. Why is the S&P 500 likely to return a very low number over the next 10 years? Because it's very, very high right now, and reversion to the mean is real.
Now, as we said earlier, there's still parts of the S&P 500 that are down. But the way the S&P 500's returns are calculated, it's based on the larger companies in there having a much bigger impact on the return. And those larger companies, the ones at the very top of the S&P 500, are way overpriced. So we can't really have a good expectation of really good returns for it into the future.
In other words, what we're trying to say, and this is very much like the year 2000, had you invested in the year 2000, had you invested money into a very, very low-cost S&P 500 index fund that basically mimicked the performance of the S&P 500, it would have been 13 years before the value of your investment, presuming that you didn't take any money out, would have been 13 years before the value after inflation equaled what you'd put in. And a lot of people don't believe that. They have a lot of trouble swallowing that in any way. It was 10 years, I think, 10 or 12 years before, even without inflation, you broke even. This is one of those times when it's very dangerous to mindlessly invest in an index fund.
Yeah.
There are, as Jake was referring, there are places in the market, and Morningstar cites them daily, that stocks, in their opinion, are undervalued. The stock market price of the stock, and we're not recommending that you invest in individual stocks by any stretch of the imagination, but the important thing is to realize there's ways to invest, and one of the poorest ways to invest at any point is to buy what's already way too high.
Right.
Although most people do that. They believe in buying high and selling low.
Yeah, and when you bring it to their attention, they say, well, no, I believe in buying low and selling high, and then they actually turn around and do the opposite repeatedly. There's lots of studies that show that. So,
and it all boils down to the fact that, and the oil market is confirming this, the West Texas Intermediate crude oil, which is the benchmark we use in the United States, dropped about 5.5% this week to $37.32. Now, that's about 40% below where it was at January 1st. The price of oil is certainly affected by supply, but it's primarily affected by demand. And the demand, the oil market is effectively saying for the next 6 months right now that the demand for oil is going to be exceptionally low. It's going to be 40% below where it was at the beginning of the year. And that is not an unreasonable assumption because when you drove in this morning, Jake, we were talking on the telephone, and there's just not a lot of cars on the highway.
Right. And we were
not a lot of trucks.
I was saying this because I kind of give this commentary every time I'm on the road on the way to the studio. It's one of the few times I'm really on the road these days. I'm driving up the road, and the traffic's down. Now, the ratio car to truck is still about the same, but even truck traffic is down. So when we lay that out, I mean, it was a very pleasant drive. I was not hung up in traffic at any point. But at the same time, that means our economy is not flowing in the way that it typically does. This is one of our measurement devices. We happen to live right on one of the big pulse centers of the United States, I-35. That trade route, just by looking at that, it's a very good way of checking the pulse of the economy of the United States. And we're running a little low still. And by a little low, I mean, I haven't seen it like this in a couple of decades. And if we're back to where we were a couple of decades ago on traffic, it means that's where our economy is too. And when we look at the second quarter, we were down about a third in our economic growth. It's an economic shrinkage of a third of our potential growth. That seems about right. And I would say we've come up since then, but if we were to measure third quarter growth against a year ago, it's still extremely negative. If we're comparing against last quarter, we're going to have some growth and people are going to hear good news. And that's really what's going to come out. Hey, economic news comes out. We're doing great compared to last quarter. Just know that doesn't mean we're still not doing great. Go ahead.
The numbers are probably going to come out around the estimates by Moody's, at least. It's going to come out around between 26 and 29% growth for the third quarter. But that doesn't mean what it sounds like it means. It doesn't mean it grew that much in the third quarter. It grew a quarter of that in the third quarter.
And it's growing based on where it shrunk from or down to last quarter.
And it's important to remember that if you lose 50%, it takes 100% gain to catch up.
Yeah.
And so it takes a lot more to catch up than it does than what we lost. It's very, very unlikely. To the point of vanishingly unlikely that the economy will be recovered by the end of the year. It'll probably be, at best, recovered to where it was at the beginning of 2019, maybe a year from now, if everything goes very, very well. And that's a big if at this point. There's a lot of things that are damaging the economy besides the coronavirus, but the coronavirus is the big one. And we, you know, it's, I don't know, it's become kind of background noise about the coronavirus. We've had 100, we're approaching 200,000 people who have died of coronavirus, COVID-19 disease in the United States, which is a pretty good sized chunk of people. It's roughly three times the typical death rate for influenza in a given year, and we're coming into the winter when it probably will get a little worse.
And then flu season's coming in with it.
There are 14,000 people have died in Texas, and now we are up to 71 deaths in Bell County. And this is one, it's growing, and this is a very important thing if you're listening in Bell County. The growth rate for coronavirus has slowed from about 3% a day, which it was at the beginning, down to 0.6% per day in the United States, which is still a big growth rate. It still has the potential to really affect an awful lot of people. In Bell County, it's growing. The coronavirus cases that are identified and confirmed are growing at 2.6% per day. Now, that is an astonishingly large number and would indicate that the number will double in about, what, 30 days?
Yeah, about a month. The number of total cases. Yeah. So we should expect, if we don't lower this transmission rate here, we should expect 28,000 people by this time in October if we don't lower the transmission rate. And we've been lowering it, just as a side note, because 2.6% is what's going on in Bell County today. 3 weeks ago, it was significantly higher than that. And 2 weeks before that, it was even higher. So we've been pulling it down. And strangely enough, for Bell County, we pulled our transmission rates down faster than the rest of the state until the state caught up and passed us up, and now they brought it all the way down. The positivity rate on the tests are down. It's down into single-digit territory, which is nice, but it still that just means we're testing more. What's happening is that we've got to maintain mask wearing. We got to stay 6 feet away from people. And why are economists talking about this? Why is it, and this is a question we get asked regularly, why do you guys talk about the virus so much? It is the single most dominant slower of the economy. I mean, you can't not talk about it as an economist. This is the reason why the economy is slowed down. So if we were just going to focus on unemployment and not talk about the virus, why did we have tens of millions of people unemployed? Well, must have been an annual layoffs or what? No, the virus is the reason. So when we come back and we look at this as economists, we understand numbers. And when we look at numbers and we see a growth rate and we say, all right, and it's funny because sometimes we understand compound interest better than we understand simple interest.
Oh, yeah.
That
for me, simple interest is a hard one for me. Compound interest is easy.
Yeah. Once we get our brains into that gear, it just stays there. And when we look back at simple interest, it throws us for a loop. But compound interest is what you're getting daily on this kind of transmission rate. It doesn't sound like a high. What, 0.6, is that what you said?
Well, it's 0.6 nationally per day. Now, that's per day.
Yeah.
It's not annualized. That's not monthly. That's not weekly. That's per day, which means after 10 days, 6% more people have been infected.
Wow.
And that is an amazingly high infection rate. It's much higher than we've had for influenza.
0.6%.
0.6% goes in. 0.6%, but in 10 days, at 0.6% per day, you have 6% of the you have a 6% growth rate. So you look at all the people who've been infected and add 6% to it every 10 days, and that amounts to a lot of people. We're down. Our daily infection rate is obviously way down from where it was. We're no longer in first place for a daily infection rate. Yay! Used to be we're in hot competition with Brazil. Now India has passed everybody up.
Yeah.
Not a good thing, but it affects the economy tremendously. There's 884,000 people this last week that filed for unemployment insurance, new filings for unemployment insurance. Now, that's normally about 200,000, and it's 884,000. Now, when they file this new filings for unemployment insurance, generally speaking, is about half the number of people who've become unemployed.
Right. It doesn't.
Because about half, round figures, about half the people who become unemployed are people who are contract workers or self-employed and go out of business.
The people that get 1099s or just have to come up with their income on their own because they're calculating it based on sales that they did in a business.
And the total number of people, and this is very interesting, despite the fact that the number of people who've been with new filings for, well, the new filing for unemployment insurance is the same as it was the previous week. It's slightly higher than it was the previous week, which is very significant because it was declining for a long time, and now it's leveled off. But it's important to recognize that if you look at the total number of people, according to the Census Bureau, unemployed, it's remained very, very constant now for over a month, about 29.6 million people who previously were working and who want to work are currently out of a job in the United States. And what's happened is we've gained back about half the people who became unemployed at the worst position when unemployment was at 15%. In our worst state, which is about April, we had a lot of people. We had about twice that number of people unemployed. We had about 60 million people are out of work. Now we're down to 29.6. But the problem is we're stuck there. And it could get worse. Matter of fact, the economists that I read are at Moody's, who seem to be more right than the others, more often right, are suggesting that if we don't get a stimulus package out of Congress in some form, well, it would have to be in a pretty broad form similar to the first one. If we get a stimulus package out of Congress like we had in the first one, then things will gradually improve. But there's a very, very severe risk, according to Moody's, that if we don't get the stimulus package, and it certainly doesn't look like we're going to get one, that we will have a high risk in the fourth quarter of slipping back into negative GDP growth, which is recession territory.
Right. The reality is that we're still in negative GDP, even though we're growing again. We're still in negative from what we were. We still call that a recovery, because we've got growth going on in there. Anytime you have growth in an economy, you're not receding. So recovery is considered coming out of a recession. But we may flirt with going back into the recession, and this is the weird part. Typically, a recession is two quarters in a row where we're shrinking as an economy. And it looks like the quarter we're in right now is going to be growth, so we would only have had one quarter of shrinkage. I'm sorry, I'm using layman speak. I should be using econ speak and saying negative growth, but I think that's such a silly terminology. So we had one quarter of shrinkage that the National Bureau of Economic Research said, hey, we're going to go ahead and call this a recession, even though we haven't gone two quarters. For some reason, we think this is a recession anyway. And everybody in the world went, duh. But yeah, so second quarter may be in growth. even though the growth, even if we have massive growth second quarter, it's still going to be nowhere near where we dropped from. So
we could get the concern, and the serious concern is that in the fourth quarter, if we don't get some new stimulus, and because they're looking at what consumers are actually doing, and you may have seen that on the highway today.
Yeah.
The absence of stimulus is causing the economy to slow back down again. We actually could go back into shrinkage or negative growth in the fourth quarter if we don't get some kind of further stimulus from the government.
And what I would say there, and this is an important thing, we haven't actually had a targeted stimulus to small business from the government. We haven't had one. And people go, wait a minute, what about the PPP? Well, the name of the PPP was not Small Business Protection. It was Paycheck Protection Program. It was to protect the worker. The business itself, I mean, if they didn't spend the right amount on employment, I mean, even if they've got a big loan on inventory that they bought in at the end of February, they got this big loan on a bunch of inventory that they've got to pay on every month. If they use the Paycheck Protection Program to pay off that loan, they could be getting into trouble right now. There weren't rules associated with the Paycheck Protection Program, and the people that are being punished right now are the people that were being absolutely fraudulent. But it clearly says it's a Paycheck Protection Program. And all along, Congress said you need to spend a large percentage of this on your payroll. Now, if you don't, it's just a loan, and you have to pay it back over time. It's a low-interest loan that has to be paid back. Well, is it a good idea for a lot of businesses that have had a huge downturn in their revenue to take big loans out just so that they can keep paying employees while the rest of their debts grow? And the answer to that is we need some other kinds of help if we don't want to see a massive, even greater massive number of small business failures. And this is something that's kind of near and dear to my heart. I lived in Austin for about 10 years and I'm back in Salado now, but Austin, I love the music scene there. I married a musician. It's just an amazing musical environment. And many of the really, really iconic music venues are gone, and they're never going to come back. One that a lot of people that don't live in Austin are familiar with, Threadgills. Do you remember Threadgills?
Mm-hmm.
That's where Janis Joplin got her start, as a waitress. And it was a music venue, so she'd be a waitress there and play there at night. And it's gone forever. It's not going to reopen because they don't have money. They're bankrupt. And that's not the only one. The music venues in Austin are being hit hard. The musicians in Austin, talk about unemployment. I mean, they were cash from the bar, 1099 employees. Now they're nothing. They don't have any money coming in. They do live streaming events, but people aren't paying them money to do it. So they're getting jobs doing other things if they can. Otherwise, they're moving back in with parents, and as are many, many other job hunters out there. And sometimes the parents are moving in with the kids. So this is still a very real ongoing calamity. The fact that we have growth right now should not distract us from that. And then the fact that we're in the middle of a presidential election, this is hard. This is really, really hard on my heart, that because we're trying to get one person or another elected and they stand so far apart on so many issues, we can't come together on the issues that we even agree on, which the Democrats are saying, yeah, we need to help small businesses, and the vast majority of Republicans are saying we need to help small businesses. But we can't do it because we're in the middle of a political fight over who's going to be the next president. And that, I think, is going to cause more lasting harm than any other action that's taken place since the coronavirus hit. That, I mean, we were slow to respond on a lot of areas. A lot of places were. We opened up in a chaotic way. We're Americans. We're all, it's like herding cats. I understand that. We're very free. We really are the land of the free, even to the fact that when there's good advice out there to follow, we don't have to follow it. That's okay. That's one of our strengths. It's also one of our weaknesses. That's just how we act in general. From my childhood, I can't imagine a time period like this clearly. But if I could overlay it, maybe it's my pie-in-the-sky concept of the way we used to be, and we were never like this, but I feel like we would have still come together in the middle of a presidential election to get something done to help out a lot of businesses that are failing through no fault of their own. It's just not happening. That is one of the things that is really, really hard for me to watch. The Federal Reserve has done its job very well, but they're not a political entity. The pharmaceutical companies are doing their jobs exceedingly well. And that includes even the slowdown on the trial for AstraZeneca's Oxford's study. That's exactly what should have happened.
It started back again today, yeah, though.
Right, exactly. Why did it start back up? Because they identified that the other cause of why that patient was showing neurological symptoms associated with viruses, and it didn't have to do with the vaccine. So, of course, they paused it, and I'm glad they did. But in the middle of this, Hertz, Century 21, not the real estate folks in this area, but the department store, Mason Kaiser, Latin American Airlines. I mean, there's a page on the Wall Street Journal that's just about bankruptcies, and usually they've got a story up there that's weeks old about a major firm failing, and now I can't read off the numbers. Blackstone Energy Alloys, they're filing for bankruptcy now. Fuddruckers, Luby's. Why are they going bankrupt right now? Well, there's people not working. They're not going to restaurants. I'm not going to restaurants. You're not going to restaurants. We may pick up stuff at the door. But what about cafeteria-style eating? Well, that doesn't happen anymore. If it does, you're likely to get sick. Are we ever going to use that kind of restaurant again? Yes, I think we are. But we're getting rid of the good restaurants, and some other restaurant's going to grow up and take its place in the coming years. I think a stimulus from the government is necessary, but I also don't think we're going to get one until after November.
Not only after November, it would have to be after January 20th, I think. It might occur in lame duck Congress, but
they might. I mean, they've got nothing left to lose, so they can cooperate if they're lame duck. And that's sometimes what happens, is that the lame duck Congress will get together and act. It gives them the ability to say, hey, this isn't a political fight anymore. Let's just get some work done. And we're not getting a lot of that right now in D.C. But we got to play some commercials.
We do.
We will be back right after with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join the conversation, we really haven't given out the email address as much. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we'll look at your question and give it an answer live on the air. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Did you want to say anything before we go?
No.
Okay. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And I was trying to talk when the microphone wasn't on. So I talked, but nobody could hear me.
That doesn't work real well.
No. Putting some hand sanitizer on my hands, and it's got aloe in it, and it's got it advertised on there. It's great. It moisturizes with vitamin E and aloe, and Oh, my hands are all sticky. Ugh.
That's no fun.
No. And just this is one of my word nerd issues. If you have to sanitize your hand, was it insane before?
Yes.
Did we all technically have crazy hands before COVID-19?
Absolutely.
Dun, dun, dun. The epidemic of mental illness in our hands has been solved.
Actually, if you could sanitize our brains, then all the election rhetoric would go away.
I'm not sure our brains are sanitizable. I mean, we could put in a sanitarium, and I think we would be, yep, we're economists. That doesn't work on us.
Let's talk about inflation for a minute. The interest rates in the Treasury bonds and notes and bills are strongly suggesting a 0% interest rate, but the Commerce Department came out with for its first estimate for August inflation. And the National All City Consumer Price Index for the last 12 months came in at 1.3%, which is certainly higher than it has been. It's a good thing. It's been up now for 3 months. For the 3 months prior to that, we had a negative inflation. We had deflation or disinflation going on, and there was the economists across the country were deeply concerned. I was concerned that we could get into deflation very, very easily. But there's been a resurgence in the price of things in general. It's kind of funny because fuel dropped 17%, and inflation seems to be bucking up very nicely in furniture and in a lot of interesting areas that I was a little surprised at, used cars. But people are buying things again. Now, they're buying things online mostly. Clothing is down. It's cheaper to buy clothing now than it has been in a long time. But the other thing that's kind of interesting in the economy is the trucking and railroad resources, particularly on the West Coast, are overloaded. There's a big backlog of things for them to haul because we are importing at a record level from Asia. That is one of the great ironies that's popped up here. Despite the fact the tariffs are still in effect, we have the largest percentage in dollar trade deficit we've had. I think we broke all records this last month in August. I'm not sure exactly, but we came really close to breaking all records for trade deficit. It's the trade deficit jumped 18%. And
that just means we're importing a whole lot more than we're exporting right now.
We're just buying an awful lot of stuff. And one of the things I think it's important to recognize about both of these issues is this surge of inflation comes after 3 months of deflation, which means we're working our way back to zero. So the fact that there's a relatively high level of inflation in goods and the kinds of services that can't be gotten overseas. In other words, plumbing, getting a tree removed from your yard, whatever you need to do physically, because it's a backlog issue. I don't think it's a permanent inflation issue. I think inflation probably is going to run pretty close to 1% or zero for a long time. The other thing that's really fascinating is that in order for American manufacturing to increase its capacity, not capacity, but increase its production, which it's trying to do really, really hard, because people are coming back and starting to buy, they're actually starting to recover in buying manufactured goods in the United States. And that's causing the factories to speed up to try to catch up to the fact that they haven't been producing for several months. But in order for a factory to produce something, let's say a car, some of the components in a car that's made in the United States are inevitably going to be made in China.
Right.
That's an important thing to recognize because it's a lot cheaper to make them in China and ship them over here. So if we're going to make more stuff in the United States, then we will see a rise in the trade deficit, despite the fact we're manufacturing more things in the United States, because we have to import parts to make that work.
Right. Not just in car manufacturing, not just in almost anything that you manufacture. If you're making a computer, chunks of it are coming from China. I mean, if you have an Arduino and you're tinkering in your garage, it may have come from Italy or it may have come from China. We need to get the capacity, the ability to make this sort of stuff automated here.
But we don't have the capacity presently. We simply don't have. If we want American manufacturing to recover and we want people to be hired in the United States to do that, we have to import some things because we simply don't have the capability in the United States to make all those things. And we got 1 minute left.
Yes. So this hour is done. We'll talk more about supply chain stuff. I think that's important. Some more about the money markets, what's happening out there, because it was something of great worry about a year ago and not so much right now. But if you would like to talk to us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice to generally to people with high net worth, but we'll talk to you anyway. Our local number is
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's our off-the-air number. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can contact us through the form there. You can listen to podcasts. You can get our newsletter signed up. Or you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been...